So we're 50 years of the beaver as our national animal. Is it still worthy of the title?
Oh, I think so. They're tenacious. They're able to work with other species. They are a great comeback story, always underrated. And they have just really been part of our current history as the country of Canada, but also very, very special to many of our Indigenous groups as well. And they represent almost the whole of the country. I remember being in Newfoundland and driving along and just amazed at the number of beaver lodges I was seeing and just how they were interacting with that landscape in areas where there's still quite a bit of rock or bogs, and all the way to the west coast and up to the north and right to the border of Canada and the United States to the south. So they really are an iconic species. And I have to tell you, March 24th was the 50th anniversary. And I always track when beavers emerge from their lodge. I call it Bee Day. It's my favorite day of the year. So you'll see in front of a beaver lodge, there's a frozen pond. And then slowly this little oasis of water starts to form right where their entrance is. And that's where beavers will pop out for the first time. And so I was like, D-Day was April 8th last year. So I've got a ways to go, but there's water there. I looked out last night and there was a beaver sitting on the ice and another one swimming right in front of the lodge. And I texted my friend, Sherry Westbrook, and I said, it's B-Day. She said, how fitting for the anniversary of the beaver becoming the symbol of Canada. So just in time for me to talk with you. The beavers have come out from their lodge and are ready for spring again.
That's Glynis Hood, one of the world's leading beaver experts and researchers. She is a professor emerita at the University of Alberta and adjunct professor at the University of Saskatchewan. She's also the author of The Beaver Manifesto. She is my guest, talking to me about beavers, marking 50 years since they officially became Canada's national animal. Welcome to all you explorers out there, armchair and in motion. I'm your host, David McGuffin. We kick every edition of this podcast off with the call of the loon, an iconic Canadian sound. Perhaps equally ubiquitous if you spend time paddling our waterways or being around our wetlands is this. The tail slap of the startled beaver, warning all around of possible danger. I've had the great honor of being around beavers most of my life and always feel a spark of joy when I see one in the wild. At the end of our lake, one of my favorite quiet spots is a swamp tucked in behind an island, right at the inflow from the lake above us. It's all cattails and lily pads, the croak and chirp of frogs and toads, birdsong, and the buzz of insects. At the northwest corner is the local beaver lodge, a dome of mud and sticks, with its doorway leading to the channels and canals they dig through the base of the swamp. I tend to follow those beaver paths as the easiest way through, paddling or pulling my way slowly forward, hoping to catch a glimpse of the engineer responsible. For my entire lifetime, that family of beavers in that swamp have been working to dam the open water between the island and the mainland. At one end, their work is made easier by a century-old wooden bridge, now mostly rotting and submerged, built when the island was still a farm. At the other end, their challenge is bigger, maybe 100 meters or more of open chest-deep water from island to land, which they have continuously worked to dam. As if some master plan is being handed down through the generations, I imagine like cathedral builders back in medieval times. The effect from one year to the next isn't all that obvious, but seen over decades, it becomes much more clear. I used to be able to canoe easily into that swamp throughout the paddling season, even at the height of summer. Now, the only time I can get my canoe over their increasingly prominent dam system is right after the ice breakup on the lake, when the spring melt has boosted up water levels. Eventually, the beaver's work will fuse the island and mainland together, and possibly in a few decades, a forest will emerge here. This is one example in miniature of the impact beavers have on our landscape right across this continent. And as Glynis Hood gets into, beavers are profoundly important to us on so many levels. Nothing, she says, other than humans is comparable to what beavers can do on the landscape. They are a keystone species with an outsized impact on the environment, and possibly a crucial one in an era of climate change and wildfires. Glynis Hood has all the info, so let's get back to her. I reached her, and I swear this is true, in the Beaver Hills of Alberta. I've been wanting to do something on the beaver for a while now, but definitely since the wildfires just a couple of years ago. And I just got to reading about what we can do, what needs to be done. And the beavers showed up in a couple of articles. They are this massively powerful tool for just bringing moisture back into onto our planet here. What is the real strength of the beaver, especially as we're facing these climate-related issues like wildfires and that sort of thing?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that make beavers really special. One is its comeback story. I mean, it was almost hunted or trapped out to extinction, both in North America and where its cousin, the Eurasian beaver, live in Eurasia. I mean, the beaver is really this animal that has shown almost a complete recovery.
Yeah, can we get into that? Because, I mean, pre-contact, pre-European arrival in North America, I mean, do we know what the population of beaver was then?
Well, it's estimated sometimes between 40 and 100 million beavers. I don't think the math was terribly well proofed, and it's really hard to know how they estimated that. But what I say, to be a little bit more cautious, is that any habitat that could hold beavers held beavers.
Yeah.
And it's an animal that goes from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to the Arctic, from the Pacific to the Atlantic. It is an animal that can adapt to incredibly diverse landscapes and still thrive. So I can imagine that pre-contact, pre-European contact, beavers were everywhere they could be. And if that takes us to the 100 millions, well, then we'll give that to Ernest Thomas Seton. But
who's going to disagree with Ernest Thomas Seton, really?
Well, there, I have some friends that would, but...
Okay.
But, yeah, so they were everywhere, and some indigenous cultures trapped and hunted beavers quite readily, and other ones didn't at all because they liked the fact that where there was beavers, there was water in drier landscapes. And so they were an animal that wasn't trapped very much in, let's say, the dry prairies, because that's where you could find water and other animals that need water.
So possibly 100 million or more. And what did we get down to, say, by the, I guess it would have been the 1920s or 30s when it really cratered, right?
I don't know what the actual numbers are. And I would challenge anybody to really give me those numbers. We can follow the legislation. And that might sound pretty odd. But we started to see in the 1920s and certainly the 1930s, and even prior to that, a prohibition on any trapping or taking of beavers across Canada. Many provinces had their own legislation. And in reality, some of that, those restrictions that were put on hunting and trapping beavers didn't come off until the late 40s, early 50s, when we started to see a bit of a comeback. So if that's any indication of how dire it was, I can give you an example. As we said, I live in the Beaver Hills. There were five different Fort Edmontons around this area because they were chasing beavers all over the landscape. By about 1870, there were no beavers here.
Yeah.
And you see this time and time again. When Europeans first landed on the East Coast, there were beavers there and the trade started. We can talk about Chartier and 1534 doing some of that early trade, even though they were really seeking out fish and other resources. But it really, really took off during that big industrial historic fur trade that we had. What we see is a disappearance of beaver populations from the east moving inland, and that really opened up this expansion of European exploration in Canada by chasing beavers because the populations had disappeared, going east, moving into the west, and then slowly into the north as well. And I think that some areas were harder to get to, so we had some natural recolonization of beavers, but there were certainly a lot of attempts to repopulate beavers through translocations.
So I was up in Wiskauganish a few years ago doing a story because it was the first Hudson's Bay Post, right? But also I found wonderful was it was also one of the first efforts to repopulate the beaver. Right? They had the Cree First Nation there along with the Hudson's Bay Company set up a very successful reserve.
Yeah, you get that in various places. I mean, Grail gets a lot of attention for his conservation of beavers.
Right.
And I actually say that Anna Harrio, his wife, was actually a little bit more instrumental in that, given Grey Owl's personality.
Actually First Nations.
Yeah. And yeah, she wasn't an imposter. but, you know, he was very charismatic, and lots of people argue that he was first Canadian conservationist, even though he really truly was a Brit and didn't have any indigenous heritage at all. But they really were able to capture the hearts and minds of people in the 1930s with Rawhide and Jelly Roll, the two little kits that they rescued from actually a parents that I think Rail had gone to trap. So, so that is one of the big sort of conservation stories about how beavers came back. But they were flying beavers up to Wood Buffalo National Park from Prince Albert National Park in 1948. I have the original reports, well, copies of them, certainly. And they, Elk Island had beavers arriving by train from Banff in 1941. So there were lots of efforts to get beavers back onto the land as well.
I mean, we can't really underscore enough just how much the beaver built this nation, right? As you say, the Hudson's Bay Company, all that exploration was really about chasing the beaver. And so, I mean, what was the appeal, you know, for the Europeans, and, you know, and how many beavers were going out, do we know, on an annual basis? And what was that like?
Well, I'll go with the appeal first. So yeah. There are only two species of beavers left in the world. One is Castor canadensis, which is the North American beaver. Mm-hmm. And then there's Castor fieber, which is the Eurasian beaver. And it mm-hmm. used to extend all the way from Britain to Mongolia up into the Russian Siberian plains and even down to northern Italy. Some people argue into Portugal. Some people even argue into the Middle East, going way, way back. So I'll give you an example of numbers there, because they are well documented. There are about 1,200 individual beavers left in all of Eurasia after that quest for beavers in Eurasia. So when Europeans came over to North America, they already had an inkling of how to eradicate beavers and trap them and hunt them and use them. And so that spurred on the fur trade here. They were furry gold, really.
Yeah.
And so what was the value of beaver? Certainly in their pelts, but it's the underfur that really made the felts that drove the trade in hats, top hats, for instance. So the higher the top hat, the more wealthy you were. You can even see it in Stetsons today, where a really good Stetson cowboy hat will have a lot of beaver fur mixed in with it. It's a really, really good hat-making product. And so the fashion industry, to some degree. Now, in Eurasia, beavers were also being used for medicinal purposes. They were being used for meat. The Catholic Church declared them a fish so that you could eat them on Fridays.
I did not know that.
So much for biology. Yeah. But they really had multiple values that way. Certainly in the indigenous people, certain groups in North America would use beavers as well for food and for clothing and tools with their bones, their teeth. There were beaver bundles on the prairies that were very important to certain indigenous groups. So some groups in British Columbia have beaver clans. Mm-hmm. So they really infiltrated many, many different cultures. But for Europeans that were coming to North America to make their great, great wealth, beavers were a commodity, very much so.
And going back even before that then, like what do we know about the beaver as a species in terms of how long it's been on this planet, sort of in a recognizable form? And what's the strength in its tenacity, I guess?
Well, there's certain studies that say about 7 million years ago, we're starting to see this evolution that is leading to the modern beaver. But I'll bring us a little bit closer to today. And there have been well over 30 different species within the beaver family. But again, only two survive. So I'm going to take you back about 10 to 11,000 years ago and show you a contrast in species that were existing here today or at that time. So one is the giant beaver, Castroides ohioensis. We find fossil remains all the way up to Old Crow, Yukon, down through, of course, the Great Lakes area into Ohio, which accounts for some its name, even down to northern Florida. And there were certain other species of giant beavers as well. It went extinct about 10,000 to 11,000 years ago. That's not too long ago. That's the end of the last major ice age. Living alongside it was our modern beaver as well, Castor canadensis, and they coexisted. Now, the giant beaver was about 100 kilos in weight, size of a large black bear. It didn't cut wood like our modern beaver does, but it was a very large semi-aquatic mammal. Living alongside it is this beaver that we see quite regularly today, and it survived. So again, another comeback story or come through story, I suppose, because it came through that mass mammalian extinction of large mammals anyways that we saw in North America nearing the end of the last ice age.
I mean, our forests were largely covered with ice. So if you think about beavers, that's got to be a challenging time for them to get through too.
Yeah, and there were certain areas that didn't have glaciation, but I would say most of the area where you're seeing beavers now had about a kilometer of ice on top of it. So yeah. With that retreat of the glaciers, you start to see landscapes having to form to what we see as our more modern landscape. And beavers were there. And so they are what we call an ecosystem engineer. It's a species that can dramatically modify its physical landscape. We see that with elephants. We see it with ground squirrel colonies where they're moving soil or they're creating pathways. But nothing other than humans really is comparable to what beavers can do on the landscape. So the three main structures that you'll see with beavers, one is the lodge. And so that's where they live. They can live in bank dens as well. Then you'll think about the dams, and that's where they block water bodies. And then they create these big ponds behind them. And they can have several dams in a system if they have larger territories. And then they have these canals that they physically dig that are either on the bottom of the ponds or they reach out perpendicular to the ponds, getting into the upland habitats. They can be used to connect one pond to the other. And these are often underrated. And beaver canals are just absolutely mind-blowing when you study them. So I started to notice them during my PhD work in the worst drought on record in Alberta in 2001-2002. Mm-hmm. And I was watching these ponds disappear. And all of a sudden I noticed all these canals that the beavers had excavated on the bottom of the ponds. And then I started noticing they reached out to the landscape. And these were the only ponds that had water in them anymore. And growing up in Southeast BC in the Kootenays, in the Creston Valley, often in the spring, farmers will dig these canals in the middle of their fields, drain them for their spring crops, and then fill them in again. And I thought, this is almost serving the same function. They're focusing water into these ponds, and we only lost about 10% of the beaver population in the worst drought in history in 137 years at the time. And these beavers managed to excavate their way through a drought, maintain water on the landscape. It was the only place you could find green vegetation. It was the only place where animals could go to water. And they made it through. And I've seen it time and time again because we're getting increasing droughts, unfortunately. Yeah. But it just fascinates me. And so we had another big drought in 2009. And I saw, again, a beaver pond that was just riddled with these canals that had been dug on the bottom of the ponds and the ones that were reaching out like fingers into the neighboring landscape. And there was a pond on an agricultural land just about 300 meters away. It had a flat bottom, no excavation. The rains came back in 2010, and that pond with beavers in it filled up almost immediately. All that water focused into it to the point where it was almost going over chest waders.
Wow.
The pond up the road took about 2 years to get water back into it. It was just absolutely inspiring to see an animal that seems to have the ability to create a landscape that is not only functional for their foraging needs and raising young, but functional for getting water back where it needs to be so that they can continue on their semi-aquatic lifestyle.
So what's the primary reason for the difference between those two ponds? Like what were the beaver doing that wasn't happening up above?
Okay, so I'm going to get you to imagine the Grand Canyon or the Badlands in Drumheller.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they look like when they're dry. They have, you know, tall mounds of soil, but they're surrounded by these deeply furrowed and dug out areas. And it just gives enough of what we call habitat heterogeneity, so that habitats that are really rich in different subhabitats. And it just allows water to focus in them. The snow seems to settle in them in the wintertime so that it almost captures the snow like ditches do and then starts to fill with that water. They also, because they're excavated, have more, I believe, an interface with the groundwater systems. So when that rain comes back and the aquifers start to recharge, some of that water can seep back into the beaver ponds as well. Whereas if you're in that agricultural pond that I described, we call them pan-bottom wetlands, think of a frying pan.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that dynamic interface with anything but the air. And so water that falls on them evaporates.
So below them effectively is like a solid pan, right? Like literally like a pan. Yeah, there is no connection to the groundwater. Yeah.
So this is part of their success. And if we go back to the ice retreat, you've got this animal that is quite capable of altering its real estate to suit its own needs. And that's been happening since the ice started retreating off of the Canadian landscape, is that beavers were there to help form it.
So to circle back to my wildfire question, and you guys really got hit out there, but it was all through Northern Ontario, Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to sort of chart where beavers were and what that impact was?
Emily Fairfax in the United States has been looking at that question using remote sensing. And in 2020, she put out a paper called Smokey the Beaver that got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using remote sensing. So they were looking at greenness indexes. So how green was the landscape that was reflected back up to the satellites? And in areas where beaver wetlands had been exposed to fire, there was not a whole lot of change in that greenness index. Areas where there weren't any beavers and the same fire had gone through had about three times less greenness index than the ones with beaver ponds. And so she speaks of it being like these ponds are a bit of a buffer. They sort of add a little bit of an oasis in the middle of these wildfires. So she's working on that kind of research. On the other hand, though, I did some research in Elk Island National Park where prescribed fire was used quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And quite intensively in some areas. And combined with really high herbivory, so vegetation consumption by other animals, particularly elk, moose, deer, bison to some degree as well. When prescribed fire was used in an area more than three times, sometimes it took well over 12 years for those areas to rebound and beavers were gone. So there is a fine line and a lot more research that needs to be done to really understand the nuances of fire and beaver. I have personally seen smoke coming out of the vent hole in a beaver lodge after a big fire has gone through, and that the dam has been tremendously damaged by this fire because there's so much woody debris in it that, of course, it catches fire. And it's very dry. If you're ever out camping and you want some really good firewood, get some of this dry beaver cut wood and it'll light up just like that. There is some indication that with these large fires, beaver ponds offer some refugia and maintain some greenness on the landscape.
Yeah.
And so I think that's quite a compelling story that's coming out.
That is very compelling. On a logical level, it just makes sense. The wetter the landscape, and beavers are very good at doing that, right? So So Wood Buffalo National Park, you mentioned that. There's apparently an epic beaver dam there. Can you tell us about that?
I actually was a park warden before I became a professor, and I was with Parks Canada for almost 20 years. And one of places I worked with Wood Buffalo National Park, so I'm sure I've probably flown over it at times, but it is a very long beaver dam, and you find this in peatland systems. So peatlands are Often you'll associate the northern peatlands with bogs and fens. So these really organically rich, deep organic soil type wetlands. And beavers just keep plugging holes over generations. And so by doing that in these really wet landscapes with lots of organic material, they can keep plugging until they create these incredibly long beaver dams. And so you tend to see these in some of these colder, more northern or high elevation peatlands where you get these really long beaver dams.
So I think I read 850 meters or something like that.
Yeah. And I have a friend that works in Alberta, and he says he sees something similar up in the northwest corner of Alberta as well. So again, that one is quite famous and certainly has got a lot of attention, and probably rightly so.
Yeah.
But where I work with Dr. Sherry Westbrook in Sibbald Fen in Kananaskis country, again, you see these little plugged dams that can go for very long extents, like 200 meters or more.
Yeah. What do we know about the impact of beavers on biodiversity in a landscape as well?
They are tremendously good at creating really diverse habitat, as I mentioned before. And so some of the work that I've done, I find that with the aquatic macroinvertebrates, they actually increase the biodiversity quite a bit. And in these canals, I've found that those are hunting hotspots for some of the predaceous aquatic macroinvertebrates. Mm-hmm. There should probably be a movie made about that, you know, just this whole hunting hotspot and the drama that must go on there.
Yeah.
But we do find that with certainly with invertebrates, we find it often with riparian songbirds. There's been lots of work done by Petra Nummi in Finland that is showing that waterfowl respond quite well to beaver ponds.
Right.
I've done one study where I was actually just trying to detect six semi-aquatic mammals. We've got six that live in Alberta, and semi-aquatic mammals are the ones that have that intermediate zone between water and land, and they are well adapted to aquatic environments like beavers, muskrat, mink, river otters. And so I thought, okay, I'll try to find these six species. We ended up finding like 86 species on our cameras that were just really in love with these wetland areas. And one of the cool things that came out of it is I had cameras posted on beaver dams as well. We had over 25 species using these beaver dams as either traveling corridors, roosting sites, hunting areas. It was just amazing the way that wildlife responds to these wetlands. And you also see it with plants as well. And sometimes fish. There are certain fish that can't tolerate beaver dams. They can't jump over them. They don't quite know what to do with them. That's a problem with beavers moving into the high Arctic or the tundra, is that Arctic grayling are not particularly well suited for beaver dams, and it can block their migration. But there's other species that are quite adept at living in beaver ponds and getting over those dams at high flow periods as well.
I mean, I guess that's part of climate change, right? As the planet warms, beavers are moving into more of that northern area becomes habitable to them. And so beyond graylings, I mean, what kind of impact do you know that it's having?
It's a quickly unfolding research area, beavers moving into the tundra. There have been beavers there on and off for a bit. So we've even had reports in Nunavik of beavers being there in the 1950s, up by Kujawak in 1970. But really, we're starting to see this real push of beavers into northern areas. So in the Vavek National Park, which is in the northern Yukon, beavers were first seen in about 2008 or 2009 by some Nuvialuit hunters.
Right.
And I've spoken to people from Tuk and Inuvik and Nunavik and Kujawak, and it's a real issue because, number one, they're not sure how caribou are responding to it, because caribou have really preferred migration patterns, and you put a beaver complex in the middle of it, that can be problematic. Grayling is a huge issue, Arctic grayling, which is a key fish species for many northern communities. And also there's the idea of permafrost. So there's lots of work being done on how much carbon might be released from the permafrost once a beaver establishes a site and starts digging away like they do. And ends up releasing that frozen ground into a melting process instead.
Right.
And then that methane starts to get released. So there are just so many questions. And there's even questions about whether beavers are going to have the same positive impact on biodiversity in the system. So out of University of Alaska Fairbanks, Ken Tate's lab is examining whether or not beavers are increasing biodiversity. And if they are they southern species that have kind of moved up north as well, as many species are migrating north with climate change? And you're getting a replacement of the original species, or are you getting a mixture of it so that you have a net addition of biodiversity? Or are you just getting the decline altogether? So this is a major area of interest in Arctic ecology.
Huh. And as you say, rapidly unfolding as all of this is right now.
Yeah, and it's tremendous, because if we go back to the fur trade, we really had lost a lot of beavers. So you had asked me earlier how many beavers were being taken out of North America, just to give you the difference from today of beavers moving all over the place. If you look at the Hudson's Bay records, over 4.7 million beavers were sold in the auction houses of Britain just between 1769 and 1868.
Wow.
4.7. So if you think about it, they had to pass the grade at the Hudson's Bay fur trade post as well. So if they weren't a made beaver, like a good quality beaver pelt, those ones were probably discarded. And so you go from that landscape, and I've examined air photos in Elk Island National Park from 1920s, where beavers had been gone since probably about the 1870s, 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dry landscape. You look at that landscape now, and it, even in drought years, you still have a lot more water than you did then.
Yeah.
And so you look at that transformation in areas where beavers have probably lived for, you know, tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
And you transform those changes up to into an Arctic tundra ecosystem where beavers aren't normally there. It's an open question as to whether or not it's going to be net negative or a draw.
So let's talk about the dams, because I mean, we just talked about a almost kilometer long one, and you know there's many that are hundred meter long or whatever, but these things are incredibly strong. So what is the secret sauce to those?
They are really interesting to study, because beavers will start at the bottom, sticking sticks at angles into the soils, and then they will start constructing around that. And they often will start at the edge and then build them out. But the really interesting thing about a beaver dam versus, let's say, a human-constructed dam, or even when people are trying to mimic beaver dams, building what they call beaver dam analogs, humans like to build relatively flat or slightly curved structures to hold back water. Beavers will do the curved structures as well, but sometimes these curves go upstream. Sometimes they curve downstream. Sometimes they curve in one part of the dam and the other part is straight, and then it goes into an opposite type of curve.
Wow.
So they really, really respond to the environment, the water flow, the water pressure that they have. They can be meters tall, meters long. They can even be a meter wide in some areas, and they can be 30 centimeters long.
Yeah.
They just plug up all sorts of things. But these dams tend to be a relatively flat upstream face, not always totally flat, certainly, very deep. But then the downstream often slopes like a little bit of a ramp. They're full of sticks. They're full of boulders sometimes.
Wow.
I've even seen PCB pipe put into them. So if you think you're going to keep your materials intact, don't count on it if there's a beaver nearby. And then they just tons of mud, and if there's mud available. But they're very adaptable in the subalpine edge with the alpine. I've even seen ones that are just completely constructed with rocks with some mud in between.
No way. So they're actually carrying rocks. That's incredible.
Oh, yeah. You'll see beavers carrying rocks.
Wow, that is amazing. So I want to get very specific. And on my lake, at the end of our lake, there's an island. And behind the island, there's a swamp. And we've been on this lake for decades. So I've been watching this happen over a long period. There's a beaver home there and has been family after family. They've dammed one end of from the island to the mainland. So it's probably 50 meters maybe there. Mm-hmm. And they've now started damming the other side. It seems like they're silting it up.
Well, they're not purposely silting up, I think. So I'd imagine that the water is coming upstream, hitting those dams, and then the silt is depositing.
Yeah.
And that sedimentation is very, very common in beaver ponds.
Yeah.
Because you've slowed the water down, so all of that suspended material now has the ability to sink. And this is very common in beaver ponds, and it actually can act as a bit of a filter for downstream flows. And so you will get that silt up, you'll get that buildup, especially behind the dam. And then they can even use some of that to help reinforce the dam again. And so what happens in some areas is once that dam blows, some of that silt then gets blown out as well and goes downstream, which can have negative effects for downstream fish and amphibians and the like. But the silting up is just a natural process, no different than what we get in reservoirs and other areas where we've actually dammed things up as well. But it's really interesting, this siltation and sediment. My colleague, Dr. Sherry Westbrook out of University of Saskatchewan, and she's done some fingerprinting of that sediment. And so she's looked at it with beaver dams, natural beaver dams, and then she's looked at it with these beaver dam analogs, the ones where people try to build fake beaver dams and streams to help restore, especially terribly incised streams and degraded systems. And with beaver dams, most of that silt is coming from the sides of the stream and where they're digging their canals and everything. So there's a real diversity of where that sediment's coming from. But for these dams that humans make, it's all coming from within the stream itself. And so if you're thinking about your lake, as the dams get built, the water rises, it goes over the edge, and you're actually bringing some of that sediment from the edge into the pond as well. So they've got a lot of different avenues in which that sediment can enter that wetland.
In terms of water quality, too, that's probably helping our lake a lot, right?
Yeah. I mean, beavers certainly carry their own share of parasites and diseases, Giardia being one for beaver fever.
Yeah.
But I have an acquaintance in Russia who was studying work on a stream that flowed past a cheese factory, actually, that was really, really polluting the stream that was going by. And she tested water quality upstream of the factory, at the factory, and then every pond that was developed with a sequence of beaver dams that had been made by beavers in that stream. By three beaver dams down from the factory, the water was as good as the upstream quality. Like they'd filtered out all of that pollutant that came from that factory, that cheese factory, by sediment settling in the ponds. But then once you get sediment in there, you also get microbes that start breaking down some of those materials. And so you get this whole microbial soup and microbial activity within those ponds that then helps break down some of these sediments and the organic materials that are attached to them.
You touched on farmers earlier, and I mean, one of the aspects of the beaver population coming back is there's just more butting heads with us, the human species on the planet too. And what are the best ways that you can see of sort of getting around that and sort of allowing us both to share spaces?
And there's a lot of work being done now on what they call beaver coexistence tools. So the Mustaki Institute and Cows and Fish in Alberta are the two that come to mind in my backyard. And I've often thought about this too, because I'm an ecologist at heart, but I turned into a wetland plumber for quite a while. And I still have some projects that are going to involve the installation of pond levelers. And so a pond leveler is a piping system where you extend the pipe well out into the pond, the end of the pipe that's going to draw the water in. You protect it by a big cage that you make. You put another pipe attached to that. So let's say a 20-foot long pipe which is double-walled attached to a single-walled 20-foot-long pipe. That goes through the dam. You set it at the level at which you want the pond to stay, and then it draws water anytime it gets higher than that. You protect the facilities. I worked with a former colleague, Dr. Varghese Manalur, who was an economist, and we actually tracked the cost of doing these versus traditional methods with dynamite and backhoes, and found that in one of our study areas that over a three-year period with 13 of these in, the park had saved on average about $80,000 of maintenance costs just by putting in these pond levelers. And wow. I've done some on agricultural lands in Beaver County, which is close by to here. And you can mitigate some of that. There's certainly trees that get cut as well, and there's fencing techniques and the like. So there are ways to mitigate flooding, which I would say is probably the most costly aspect of beaver engineering, where they're creating their dams and flooding things. Sometimes just where we build, I think, can help moderate some of the conflict as well. So I've seen development permits given during dry years where people are actually building what I know is a wetland.
Right.
And they're putting their house there, and or right next to a stream where I know that there's beavers, that is great habitat for beavers. And so if we design our own facilities in a way, trail systems as well, that can sort of bypass some of these key lowland sites where we're going to get lots of flooding, we might be able to have a little bit less conflict there too.
Are there other beaver encounters that you've had personally that have stuck in your mind?
Oh, there's so many. I'm always asked if there's a favorite, and I'm not a person that's had a favorite, but certainly when I'm out on my little canoe, you can imitate the sound of a beaver, and sometimes I can get them to swim up, and then they get frustrated that it's me and they slap their tail. There's been times when I've seen a big adult beaver just swim away once the water is open enough with the ice breaking, swim away from the lodge that it's stayed in with its family for the whole winter, and just sit on a beaver lodge, sit back on its haunches and start oiling its fur and kind of looking like it's sitting in a lawn chair, just letting the sun hit it. And there's moments like that. I think one of my favorites is when the kits come out from their lodge for the very first time. And so that's either late June, early July around here. And I watched this little kit come out, and it was first time swimming outside the lodge, and it slapped its tail, freaked itself out so much that it dove in. It never came out for the rest of the day. I don't think it knew the power of its hind end. And so there's little vignettes like that that kind of stay in my mind.
Going back into your own childhood, I mean, is this been a lifelong thing for you? Is there a moment you remember beavers not being in your life, or when did beavers come into your life?
Well, I would say that they've probably been there forever, because I grew up in the Creston Valley, which it has a wetland that is of international significance, a Ramsar site with the Creston Valley Wildlife Management Area. So they were always there. I you know, I've had to portage my canoe over dams even as a young teenager. And certainly growing up on Kootenai Lake, there's sticks that float to shore, and people would tell you what happened to that stick, why it was chewed and peeled. So I've always had that with me. I think where my research interest really took off was my PhD. And I'd done my master's degree looking at grizzly bear habitat suitability. I'd worked with all sorts of different species. And I thought, well, after my PhD's done, I'll go into that general pool of what species are out there and where the research questions lead. The questions with beavers never stopped. And so over 25 years later, I'm still exploring questions related to beavers and really, really enjoying the journey.
Beautiful. And the last question I ask everyone is to name a favorite place in Canada, but I'm going to ask you to name a favorite place with beaver, which is probably not that. There's a lot of places you can choose from.
Certainly, my doorstep is lovely. I mean, there's four beaver lodges on the pond. Certainly, a family will only live in one of the lodges over the winter. So, but I the first thing that came to mind is paddling into Kingsmere Lake in Prince Albert National Park, and hiking the trail over to Grail's Cabin, and on Anjouan Lake, and going into Grail's cabin and seeing the beaver lodge built within the cabin. So they have an access from the outside. There's a paddle on the wall that was Grail's. And then you see Anahario's cabin up on the hill. The graves are right there. And it's just sort of this ultimate Canadian moment, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And those beavers are the offspring, presumably, of Rawhide and Jelly, right? And that's
And Rawhide and Jelly Roll were some of our first major celebrities in Canada. I mean, what country can boast that?
Yeah.
But I just think it's just an iconic journey to go into Prince Albert National Park, go into Grail's cabin, paddle part of the way. You can paddle the whole way if you want to portage. And that this was just really the start of a conservation story in Canada. Sure, there's some flaws in it, but it still has some wonderful, wonderful aspects to it. And that it worked.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most promising things. I know things can feel quite dire sometimes with the environment. And if you sit near a beaver pond, you can remind yourself that sometimes things can get so difficult for species, so difficult for the environment that you think it's hopeless. And then you see the water come back and you see the species skimming across the top of the water and just everything around it responding in kind. I just think that gives me hope.
That's beautiful. I think that's a great place to leave it. Glynis Hood, thank you so much for coming on the Explore podcast.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's lovely to meet you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I really do appreciate you checking in on these interviews every 2 weeks. To learn more about beavers, check out the excellent article in Canadian Geographic magazine by my colleague, Brian Banks, which is available on the CanGeo website. For full access to Canadian Geographic magazine and all its award-winning journalism, consider getting a subscription. It's just $28.50 a year for 6 print issues delivered to you and unlimited digital access. To sign up, go to cangeo.ca/subscribe. You'll be very happy that you did. If you like this podcast, please rate and review us where you listen. It helps others to find these interviews. And share a link of episodes you enjoy with friends and family. It's the best way to spread the word. Until next time, when we'll explore again, I'm David McGuffin.
I think right now we're enjoying very much looking back at the Earth, and it's just a fantastic experience, and I just can't wait to get back and start telling people.
We left Simpson about June 10th with a fur brigade consisting of a number of yacht boats, each manned by 10 voyageurs.
For us Inuit, it means that Inuit oral history is very strong.
And we flew low over every inch of the country that it could be. We were hoping that he would fire at us.
Oh, I guess 160 dives or so.
Well, I'm a first for Canada.